this one.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Good stuff.
I was just doing that as backup.
Okay, it's good to have backups and backups. Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, good late afternoon, late morning to you. And we're in It's 11:45, the 18th of October, and you are in the Metro East. And we are about to start the session about Uniform Rapid Suspension System, or URS, which of course in Latin has a certain connotation to Ursa, which means bear. Well, I've got a very distinguished panel here up with me, and my name is Olof Nordling. I'm with ICANN staff, responsible for trying to implement this, or the efforts to implement the URS. To my right, I've got Christine Dorain from the National Arbitration Forum, which will make a presentation later on. And to my left is David Roach Turner from the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, make also a presentation. And we have got Bart Bartolio and Paul McGrady to also follow on with a short presentation later in the program. So without further ado, I would like to go on to just show the agenda as it is. I'll make a very short introduction and brief update of where we stand in the proceedings with the URS. And then we get a couple of suggestions for changes from the potential providers of such, followed by comments and discussion. And then we go into a little discussion about process aspects and what we do next, and try to conclude on that note. So, brief update on where we stand. Well, once upon a time, the URS was conceived by two consecutive community groups, the IRT and the STI, as a complement to the existing UDP, which will be valid for new GTLDs, but this would be an addition, a complement, to resolve very clear-cut cases of trademark infringement through domain suspension, in contrast to the remedy in the UDRP. It is intended to be fast and inexpensive, in the bracket of $350 to $500. But, well, since about a year, doubts were beginning to come whether these objectives actually can be met with the procedure as it's currently drafted and included in the applicant guidebook for the new GTLDs. So, a session was held at the ICANN meeting in Prague in June this year, where a number of suggestions were brought forward by the community for potential changes and how to better meet the objectives of the URS. We have followed that up with a number of activities. First of all, we compiled the Prague suggestions and grouped them in four categories. We also, in order to test the market, how big is the problem, is there a problem, we issued a request for information on the 24th of September to gather information and see where we can go. I mean, what does the world map look like among the providers in this regard? We also contacted GNSO and ALAC, since they were at the core of the community efforts, which I talked about earlier, the IRT and the STI, in order to get process advice. If we want to change something, how do we do that in a balanced manner with taking into account all viewpoints that are, of course, very, very important in this. And we also established a new microsite, you could say, a new web page for the recent activities regarding URS, and you can read that for yourself on the screen. And we held a webinar in order to discuss further in depth the proposals for change we received in Prague, and in order to gauge the interest and the preferences in the community for those. And, of course, now we're here on this particular session where the meat of the matter is really to hear from the providers what are the problems, what are the solutions, and what can we do to discuss and find a way forward in this matter. And I may add that there is certainly an urgency to this as well, since we do need to have providers lined up fairly early next year in order for the real implementation work to be finalized before the first GTLDs actually go live. And that the schedule for the new GTLD process has been advanced, as you know, so the pressure is even more with us here. So now I would like to proceed and hand over to Christine Dorain from National Arbitration Forum. Now, let's see here. That's my little final slot. So, please, the floor is yours, Christine.
Thank you. This is Christine with National Arbitration Forum, and I want to apologize in advance. I'm recovering from a cold, so I've been coughing a lot. So hopefully I can, you know, keep that down during this presentation. What I'd like to talk about today are, as an experienced UDRP provider, who has been providing UDRP services to over 19,000 for over 19,000 complaints over 12 years. Some of the problems that we see with the current URS as it's proposed, we have put together sort of a list of some things that we would propose to change to help streamline things and make them a little bit more cost-effective so that we can meet cost targets. And one of the things that I want to demonstrate is a portal that we developed in a completely technology-based solution we developed for XXX's RES process. And just share a little bit with you as far as how something like that could look and how it could work, because I know sometimes fear of the unknown and wondering how that would look or how that might affect me or my clients is a really big issue. And then, and this is probably where I'd like to focus most of my attention, is on other questions that I don't have suggestions for. So, for instance, in the RFI, it's been pointed out that there's been no direct request for a cost target, but we know that the cost really is a driving factor for all of this. So, in the URS, if you've read it clearly, you will see that there are many, many ambiguities, many places where things are left to providers, left to discretion, suggestions made by the team that have really no implementation in them. So there is not an entity on the planet that can actually submit a response to the RFI without answering some of those questions on their own and filling in those gaps. So I just want to point out that where those gaps are and where there may still be need for community discussion, even among some of the other things besides sort of the hot-button topics that we've been talking about the last few weeks. Generally speaking, from the forum's standpoint, the URS has too many administrative touch points. They have pretty much the identical administrative touch points as the UDRP, plus some, and they're asking the providers to charge about a third of what they typically charge for a complaint. When you think about it, that is about the amount of money that the provider keeps for the administrative handling of the case, which doesn't leave any money left over for the examiner. So that leads me to the next suggestion, which is if we send a case to what is called in the URS an expert examiner for a default or prior to receipt of a late response, and this is a typo here, it should say increases inefficiencies. I'm sorry. So when we have a response case and we have to pay an examiner, the provider is probably going to about break even with technological improvements that I'm going to talk about. Maybe not. Maybe it'll be a little bit of profit in there, but not much. So the way the provider is able to sort of recoup those costs and make the program even worth running as a business, one suggestion is to either to not pay for an actual written expert determination. And one way to do that would be to allow the provider to appoint an in-house lawyer or, you know, sort of have a one particular person on retainer who, you know, reviews all of those cases so that, you know, what we refer to as the crazy or insane complaints don't get through. So some of our key suggestions are going to be that Communications are all provided electronically, which is in the URS now. But that we would be, that the URS would be modified to include the use of a portal system. And I'm going to demonstrate the way the RES works in just a minute. Of course, we would probably agree with most of the community that the actual moment of service, which is when the respondent's notified, is a pretty critical point. And our particular proposal would suggest that we do include mail and fax service of notice as well. Currently, the complainant is uploading registration proof of use, and the URS says that proof of use can be validated by the Trademark Clearinghouse. The RFI seems to suggest that there might be some interface between the provider and the clearinghouse. I know that one original version, or I don't know about original, one iteration of the URS had suggested a direct connection between the URS provider and the Trademark Clearinghouse. We don't, because that's not determined yet, and we don't know if the provider is going to have to connect, and if the provider is going to have to request data, and if the provider is going to have to pay for that data. Again, that's a cost ambiguity open to the provider as far as where, you know, is that extra steps that the provider is going to have to do? Are those steps going to be automated or through an actual staffer? Or is it going to cost the provider money every time it needs to get data from the clearinghouse? So there's a question there, and I know that there's some talk in the community about whether or not a direct connection between the URS providers and the clearinghouse is going to happen. So our suggestion is we actually would prefer to leave it where the complainant submits what they want to submit and don't put it in the provider's hands to try to go gather data on behalf of the complainant. But in the event that the community is going to disagree with that, we're concerned that that would be an additional touch point and or cost point. Probably the most controversial topic that we've been discussing over the past few weeks or months is the idea of what if a respondent doesn't respond and a case is going to default, at least early in the process. If you remember right, the URS currently as written allows a respondent to come back for 6 months and then still says they can get a 6-month extension. Our proposal is that default cases would proceed to a check for a prima facie case by some sort of attorney, maybe an entry-level attorney trained or something, but probably not someone that rises to the level of an expert examiner. And that would not result in any sort of public determination that would be citable against either party. And that we would reduce the response period from, we would leave it to the 6 months, which is incredibly long, but not include the 6-month extension because the provider at some point has to decide that the case is closed and keeping a case open for a year is not good business as far as, you know, how we manage our books and that sort of thing. So those are some suggestions that we have as far as how there could be some mitigation of the sort of concerns that some people have with the default process that's been proposed, which is to include an actual examination by somebody besides just an administrator person. And then not making those determinations public so that they wouldn't actually weigh against a party if, in fact, the provider had made a mistake or something like that. And then, of course, you still have the respondent still has that 6 months to come back. So that would be one of our key components as far as what we would suggest for keeping the cost down but still meeting the community's concerns. And then we have other suggestions. For instance, there's a lot of places throughout the URS that refers to 24 hours. Well, that doesn't take into account weekends or holidays. We would suggest that, you know, we define a business day. And for instance, I went through the URS and came up with about 10 terms that should probably be defined. So there are places through the URS that you can see it's clearly not a developed policy at this point. It is a really good list of elements, and it's got a really good list of suggestions, but it's not an actual fleshed out, fully formed policy yet. So there is work still to be done. Finally, I think this is my last slide on this point, but The current URS requires the provider to do a deficiency check for response and then says the panel is going to consider everything anyway. So there's no point in that administrative touch point as well. You might as well just do what we're doing for the UDRPA, which is sending the response right to the panel if that's if a response is had. So I want to walk through very quickly and just show you generally how the forums portal system works. Like I said, we've used technology to really streamline the process. And this is not true yet for UDRP cases. This is only for the RES cases under .XXX. And what happens is the party logs in. They're given a secure login. And they choose whether or not they're the complainant themselves or the representative. And then they agree. In the UDRP, they have, and in the RES, they have sort of things you have to say, I promise not to, sue you or whatever. So those are there's some agreements that you have to click through there. And then the next statement allows the complainant to enter their information. Now, once you have created a user ID, that information pre-populates. So that makes that step really easy. The next time, you can go ahead and just, your information pre-populates. And if you want to update it, you can. It won't update it at your record level, but it would update it for that particular case. So if you're traveling or something, you could easily update the information. You enter the domain name. In this case, I picked something nice and generic in .XXX. So it was going to fill in with ICM registries information. But our system goes out and pulls the WHOIS record for you, dumps in that information into the record. And you have a chance again to update it. If you know that the respondent's somebody else, you could change that if you wanted to. Then it asks you in the RES, you have to choose whether it's a trademark case or an impersonation case. So in that case, this is the selection you're going to make there. And then you get to enter your complaint information. Text boxes limit the number of words you can include, or they limit the number of characters, and allow you to upload documents at the appropriate point. So this is one way in which it reduces an administrative touch point because my case coordinators don't have to go through and check and make sure all the pieces are there. You've had to fill in every single piece. So the benefit it's going to have to the complainants, and actually it works the same way for respondents, is that you kind of can't screw up. You kind of can't get a deficiency because you've already filled out the form as it's designed to be filled out. And this shows the bottom half of the page. In the RES, there are additional factors, and you can click on those, and you'll get additional text boxes. And that's not necessarily applicable under the RES. Then the system starts sending emails, and it sends emails to the parties. So you can see that the actual complaint document is attached as a PDF to the parties. You can't see that because it's the email addresses are stifled on our test system. But you can see that this is sent as a regular email with attachments. And our system also sends a text email that tells the respondent specifically, you just got an email, it's not spam, you've been served with a complaint. If you want it sent to you in a different way, let us know. Here's the portal link to it, and it's an encrypted link for the respondent to use. So the respondent can't be impersonated unless they have, somebody intercepts the email. I'm sorry, I clicked it on my screen, but not for you. So this is an email that the respondent gets. Then the respondent will walk through the same steps, so I'm not going to walk you through it. But they're presented with the actual the text box screen that the complainant got, but then they can click at the hyperlinks at the top of each box to see what the complainant has argued. So when they want to go to respond, the text of the complainant's argument is right there available for them, as is the actual language of the policy. So they can click right from this page. They don't have to have the PDF. They don't have to have anything that was sent to them. They can go right to here and respond. And then you can see this is what the panel sees. And again, this is our test system. So there's a lot of random test cases in here. But you can see what the panel sees, and then they go in and select a case. Actually, it's the same thing that the parties see. The panel portal and the party portal look the same. An interaction through the forum is done through this portal. You can request a stay, or you can request a withdrawal, or you can pay fees, whatever it is. It can be done right through the portal. And then the panel also goes in and makes a decision. In this case, for RES, there's some options that are different from the URS. But they can build their decision right online. gives them the elements. They get to fill it in with the paragraph format, and if they want. And then the generation is built as a PDF. The decision is built as a PDF for them. So that's just a quick walkthrough of sort of how the portal system works, how the notice works, just sort of showing you what a technological solution could look like and how the forum believes that if we were allowed to use this portal system, if we were to write some, you know, write it into the URS to make that applicable, we absolutely could lower our costs for URS just sort of based on volume and use and the fact that we could have far fewer case coordinators and administrative people handling these cases if you use a technological solution like this. And then I think I just have like 2 minutes left or something, don't I?
Make it three.
Okay. So I just want to quickly highlight for you, these are sort of open-ended questions and things that the community needs to discuss or somebody needs to discuss, because as people are preparing to submit RFI responses, these are open-ended things that are left in the URS that are not dealt with. For instance, the URS says multiple respondents are okay if they're related. But currently in the UDRP, we have this deficiency check process. If the case is against 10 respondents, if there's 10 domain names, they're all registered to a privacy service. The privacy service writes back and says, hey, not us, there's 10 respondents. We can tell the complainant a UDRP case is between one complainant and one respondent. In this case, we can't do that because the URS says it's going to go against whoever's in the who is. How does that affect privacy services? What if you have this 10 domain name situation and you have responses that filter in over the 6 months or a year that responses are allowed to be filtered in for? At what point does the provider call it done? At what point do we send the case to the examiner? How many determinations does the examiner have to issue for its fee of what it's going to make, about $150, or whatever the panel's going to make for this case? So there's some open-ended issues here as far as you know, what happens in this multiple respondent scenario. And then, of course, there's some issues of just document drafting. URS has, you know, doesn't appear to limit the complaint, but then does limit the number of words of explanatory text and then limits the amount of words that respondent has. So there's some ambiguity going on there. One version of the URS has said that all the proceedings would be in English. This version does not. It says that the written notice has to be sent to the respondent in the language of the region listed as in the who is. Again, you go back to the privacy service. If the privacy service is in, you know, the United States, but the respondent's located in France, they're going to get an English notice, not a French notice. And the new, like I said, with this new version of the URS, we don't really know what language is the complaint, what language is the response allowed to be in, what language does the determination have to be in. What if in the case of the 10 respondents, we get responses in 10 languages? These are things that raise the cost to the provider. A straight, what I call telephone poll decision, where you get a complaint, you process it through the technology that we have, you know, it's one domain name, panel quickly makes a decision. Yep, I'll tell you that right now. I can do that for $500. It's all of the variables that we see every day through 12 years of practice doing this that raise the cost. And that's where the problems are coming in. Again, we talked a little bit about the trademark clearinghouse interaction, so I'm not going to talk about that slide. There's some additional administrative hassles in URS 6 as far as restricting changing of the content after the complaint defaulted, which makes no sense and requires policing steps and administrative steps and hand-holding. The domain name or response received after default, the domain name has to re-resolve to the original IP address. Who keeps track of that? What if the response comes a year later? Who knows what that original address was? Who's responsible for keeping track of that information? And then again, with the abuse of complaints or material falsehoods, it's not entirely fleshed out whether those go against the party or counsel. What if there's multiple complainants or respondents? Does it attach to all? What happens if there's privacy or proxy services? And then the URS specifically says the providers need to work together to come up with a solution for how they're going to publicly make this information or how they're going to keep track of this information. So assuming the providers do that and it doesn't additionally raise a lot of extra cost for the providers, does that list of bad actors have to be public? So those are some of the questions, and I'm not necessarily, I think, inviting people to the microphone at this moment, but things to discuss.
Thank you very much, Christine. And please keep the questions for a little bit until David has made his presentation. But just responding on one of the early question marks you brought up on the interaction with the Trademark Clearinghouse, and like you suggested, that's, and I think I'm pretty safe ground in this regard, although the Trademark Clearinghouse is still also a subject for detailed implementation, that this would be left to the complainant to interact with the Trademark Clearinghouse in order to get the justification for the rights that he claims, and for you just to receive and verify that this actually comes from the Trademark Clearinghouse. With that, I would like to go straight ahead and hand over the control and the floor to David to tell what WIPO has in mind when it comes to URS 2.0? Question mark. You're on, David.
Well, thanks very much, Olaf, and Christine also for that presentation. Good afternoon, everybody. My name's David. I'm from WIPO. We do UDRP cases. We've done about 24,000 of those since 12 years ago. I should say at the outset, I'm not sitting up here because we're necessarily expressing an interest in being a URS provider. There has been some discussion ongoing in the community for some time now about ways to possibly improve the efficiency of the URS, and we're here to make a contribution to the community's discussion, continuing discussions on that subject. We hope it's a helpful contribution. We heard from Olaf in the introduction. Of course, I think everybody's pretty familiar by this point what the URS is intended to be. Obviously, it's intended to deal with clear-cut cases of abuse, to be an efficient and low-cost process, and to include, importantly, appropriate registrant protections, and to operate in natural complement to the UDRP, which provides a transfer mechanism for clear-cut cases of cyber-squatting currently. WIPO's role historically in this process, I think, has been ongoing, like many in this room, for a number of years. We've been involved in discussions on this subject going back to 2009. I've included in the materials, you can see there are some links to some of our comments which we've posted on our website and which are available on ICANN's website as well. I'm not going to go into detail on them at this point because I think Christine has already covered very comprehensively a number of the challenges that we're all aware of with respect to the implementation of the URS. I'm very happy to come back to any of them in questions if people would like to. I should also mention that there's a copy of these slides along with a copy of the discussion paper, which is available on the website for the Toronto meeting for this session. If people want further information, I would suggest that you have a look at those. There are some copies as well of that discussion paper, which you can see over here at the table next to each of the microphones at the front of the room. I think there's been some extensive discussion also most recently in the Prague session about some of the main cost drivers of URS 6. Christine mentioned a number of those. The principal drivers I've distilled here on this slide, there are others, but the ones that are summarised here are, of course, the cost of appointing an expert to make the determination in UDRP cases, at least at WIPO. The panel that's appointed typically comprises two-thirds of the cost. The requirement under the current URS for a de novo expert review for a period of 30 days after the non-submission of a response, for which the expert would need to conduct that de novo review gratis. The procedural complexity, I think, which Christine has already done a good job of describing for us, the fact that you've got a mechanism currently that has a significant number more moving parts than the UDRP. Of course, this means that there's more for providers and also for parties, potentially registries as well, to do in the process. That naturally comes at a cost. It's a model that currently includes a number of enforcement layers. It's got a first phase and a second phase and an option for a respondent to come back in default cases, one of which I just mentioned, the 30-day period, and an additional period for 6 months after that for a supplemental fee. And it provides for a remedy that is quite a light remedy. It's reversible. It effectively means that the domain name registrant, if they're unsuccessful, will have their domain name no longer resolve. But that is a remedy that is reversible, and I think it's important to bear that in mind when we're considering the volume of process that we need to wrap around that remedy. Also, Christine mentioned the question of language, and I think it is important to stress this. The current requirement in the policy requires notifications by the provider to go to the registrant in the predominant language of that registrant's region, which is potentially not just an uncertain requirement, but also a potentially very onerous one. If you can imagine notifying, for example, a URS complaint in India, for example, where there's over a dozen official languages and over 100 unofficial ones. So I think what we've all been doing collectively, certainly since Prague, has been thinking a little bit about ways that we can make the URS the success that we all want it to be. There have been a number of suggestions, I think, that have come in from all corners of the community, which have been really useful. I think you could probably describe, and Olaf, I think I kind of have done a good job in grouping those suggestions into four broad categories. I think, has been to consider options for involving ICANN and ICANN ombudsman in the process. Another has been to think about ways to build filing efficiencies into the process. I think to a very significant extent, those filing efficiencies would, of course, already need to be presumed. Certainly at WIPO, when thinking about this model, we've been thinking about a system that would need to be efficient, it would need to be online, it would need to be form-based, it would need to feed directly into case administration databases, and hopefully it would need to plug directly into the clearinghouse as well, although of course there's still a question mark over the cost of that interaction if it would go ahead. There's a question about whether it would be appropriate for ICANN to become involved in subsidising the model. And there have been proposals, including from WIPO, for the introduction of a default-based system. And that's what I'd like to speak about a bit today in a little bit of detail. And there are some principles, I suppose, that have underlined our questions, that have underlined our consideration of the best approach. And I've displayed those there on the screen. I won't read them. I think you can see them. But the model that we have proposed to achieve the effect of simplifying and making the URS more efficient while also preserving important registrant safeguards is displayed up here on the slide. It was sketched out also in discussions in Prague, but we've visualised it. You can see it up there on the screen. And the way it would work in essence would be that you would have a complaint that would come in. It would be obviously an e-filing. It would come in via a form-based complaint online. It would be direct to the provider. There would then be a compliance validation process that would be performed by the provider, including ensuring that the complainant had provided the necessary demonstration of registered rights and that they'd made the appropriate declaration as to the truth of the contents of their complaint, the claims made in them. If there would be shortcomings with the complaint procedurally that were significant, the proceedings would simply be discontinued with no need to bother the respondent further. That discontinuation would be without prejudice to the filing of a future complaint. If the complaint would be procedurally compliant, and this would be an objective compliance process, it wouldn't be a substantive determination, although, of course, it would serve the purpose of filtering out abusive complaints or complaints which had no merit or were merit in a procedural sense or that were clearly abusive or were not otherwise paid for. In any event, the registrar would then be requested to lock the domain name, and the domain name would remain locked for the remainder of the proceeding. The proceeding would then be notified by the provider using a UDRP standard that is to say notification by email with written notice sent by hard copy and facsimile to the registrant to maximise chances of effective notice. There would need to be, as I mentioned, I think some need to clarify the way that the language provisions operated, but that notice in any event would be on the basis of a concise and slightly more certain language policy, languages to be determined. There would then be a period of time for the respondent to submit a response, and there would be a hardwired response reminder that would be sent to the respondent prior to the due date for the submission of their response. Both the notification and the response reminder would remind the respondent that the consequence of not submitting a response would be that the domain name would be suspended. It would not result in a substantive determination against the registrant, but it would result in an objective consequence, which is suspension, and that suspension would be reversible by the respondent on the submission of a response. If the respondent would submit a response by the due date, then and it would be a form-based response, and it would be important that the form-based response be relatively simple for the respondent to complete and to submit, but would also require sufficient information and a certification so as to control for the risk of respondents submitting responses solely for the purpose of discontinuing the remedy. So, if, for example, a response that would contain no information, or a response that would be populated by one full stop or a word, but would not constitute a procedurally valid reply to the complaint would not have that effect, but any other response that was duly certified would cause the URS proceeding to be discontinued from that point. And the mechanism would include a 15-day lock period, that's the period currently provided under the UDRP, which would enable a complainant, if they wished to initiate a URS process in which an expert would be appointed or could be appointed to make a substantive determination on the criteria, or to commence a UDRP proceeding if they wished to do that. If the respondent would default, as I said, the domain name would be suspended, that is to say it would not resolve, and it would, as is contemplated under the current policy, resolve to a website provided by the provider, which would simply indicate that the respondent had failed to submit a response and that the domain name had been suspended pending any submission of a response for the remainder of the registration of the domain name. Importantly, if at any time after the granting of that temporary remedy, the respondent would wish to submit a response, it would have an opportunity to do that, and it would have an opportunity to do that at no cost for the remainder of the registration of the domain name. And this is important because it empowers the respondent with the tools that it needs to lift the suspension. And this is important, obviously, for a number of reasons. There are cases in which a respondent may be unable to submit a timely response. There may be cases in which, of course, the use may be, from the respondent's perspective, entirely legitimate. There are questions of free speech that, of course, need to be considered, other legitimate uses. And the reason for proposing an option for the respondent in this way is because it means that the respondent is never in danger of not being able to address the remedy at no cost in terms of the filing fee that they would need to pay. So that's why we've built that in. The advantages we think that a model like this offer, I've summarised there on the slides on the screen. It's simple, it's scalable. You can modify the time periods that would apply at the various phases. It's straightforward and it's efficient. It's got fewer moving parts than the UDRP, and it will be commensurately cheaper to administer the procedure for it. It does include enhanced registrant safeguards that we believe ensure that registrants should give registrants sufficient confidence to feel that if a mechanism like this was operational, there would be scope in each and every case for registrants who feel that they have a good case to submit a response and to have the reversible effect of the process turned around. It would then be incumbent on the complainant, if they wished to proceed further, either to proceed to request the appointment of a URS expert for a supplemental fee And that expert would then be in a position to render a determination under the criteria, and that would be a non-reasoned decision to keep the price manageable and effective. And of course, it would be without prejudice to the complainant's option to use the UDRP if it wished to do that. We think that this is a logical complement to the UDRP for a number of reasons, including because it means that the URS in effect becomes a mechanism to deal with defaults. And in the UDRP, the majority of cases are defaults. It would leave the UDRP to deal with the remaining, so to speak, contested disputes and for reasoned decisions to be issued in those cases. This is useful because it also introduces a clean division between the two mechanisms. There is no replication of function, there's no risk of or reduced risk of forum shopping, and there's a obviously greatly reduced risk of inconsistent jurisprudence and decisions being issued across the two mechanisms, because it's only under the UDRP that you would get a reasoned result. We think that a really important concept in this whole discussion that we're having as a community here is the notion of sustainability. And when I use that term, I mean not just in terms of the feasibility of making an initial bid to provide the services under the mechanism, but the ability to responsibly continue to offer those services in the longer term at the price point that is promised. Because there is a real risk that if we are too ambitious about the price point that we set, particularly if we're coming at that question with less experience as a provider, with less familiarity about some of the complexities that can result, we can be too keen about offering a price that is too competitive and only in years to come find that we can't continue to offer that price. And that's something that we believe is important to try and avoid. For WIPO, we're not looking at this equation because we're a for-profit provider. We're not. And we don't make money in net terms on our UDRP operations, and we certainly wouldn't be in the event that we would be interested in providing under the URS. But we do believe that it's important that it's a model that's able to continue to offer for complainants and also for respondents who under the current URS model are also obliged to provide a response fee in some cases, a realistic prospect that those cases, those fees will remain reasonable through time. And that's why we think that it's important to get the design right now, because the risk, of course, in having ICANN get into discussions about subsidising for a limited period of time is that it only provides a solution for the duration of the subsidy. And that, we think, is a problem. So that's why we've proposed this option. Obviously, it's something that the community needs to think about. If there's any questions on it, I'd be happy to address those now.
Well, thank you very much, David, and thank you, Christina. I think we both received questions, very poignant questions, and needs addressing, and also two ways of approaching alternative, you could say, not really alternative, but modifications of URS. And quite a lot of information to digest. So at this point, I would like to open for 5 minutes of clarifying questions. But just clarifying questions, please. We keep the discussion until a little bit later. So here comes a clarifying question from Jeff. Please, go ahead.
Jeff Newman, I'll make mine a clarifying question. I apologize I missed the beginning because we were in a GNSO council meeting. Also, apologize for my voice. Did you say exactly what the price was? I saw that one-third of it was for administrative costs. But at the beginning of this presentation, can you just clarify what the exact price you said was? Both, actually.
I take it it's directed to both. Okay. Well, David, have a go at it first then.
I mentioned a price in reference to the UDRP, and in the context of the UDRP, the price that we offer for a single panel, single domain name disputes, $1,500, and that comprises $1,000 that's payable to the panel and $500 that's retained by the provider to administer the dispute. I didn't proffer a price estimate for the URS.
Okay, Christine.
We have a similar fee arrangement with the majority of our panelists, with a few outliers. But most panelists would follow the same structure that David just described. We also have not proffered a price for the URS.
Okay, when is the RFI results going to come out, that be published for everyone to see?
If I remember right, we're into late November with a deadline for it. Probably slips my mind, something like the 20th.
Right.
Yep. Following that, I think, now I have to check this, but of course, to be able to provide the information that can be disclosed should be possible fairly soon after that.
Okay, I mean, that's my last question. I certainly have a lot of comments. So if you could let me know when we're going to do the comments, I'll step back up.
Comments will following Paul's and Bart's presentation.
Yes, Philip Corwin, Council of the Internet Commerce Association. I'd like to get some clarification in the instance, and it's particularly important because the board the last year under some pressure from the GAC cut the response time from the registrant down to 14 days. In the event of default between the NAF and WIPO proposals, is there at a minimum a determination that the complainant actually possesses the claimed rights in the trademark or name at issue? And Christina, you referred to someone making at least a prima facie determination. What does that consist of? And in the WIPO model, is there an attorney looking to determine that that it appears to be a black and white incontrovertible case of infringement, or is it just an automatic loss without that review by an attorney when there's a default?
Thanks, Phil. NAF's proposal is that somebody with trademark credentials would look over every complaint that defaulted and make sure that the complainant had provided their registration, had provided the proper proof of use, and had made, you know, colorable arguments. Very similar to the way Neustar's Nexus policy works for .us. It's a case, it's a situation where the provider does a prima facie determination to make sure the complainants brought their complaint. And if the complaint or the respondent defaults, an additional letter is sent. And if the respondent still doesn't respond, then the decision just goes for the respondent and its cancellation. So that would be very similar to how we work that process.
Yes, thanks for the question, Phil. Indeed, under the WIPO proposal, we would contemplate that there would be a validation of the trademark rights that would be claimed by the complainant. That could occur in one of two ways, obviously via the clearinghouse, it would be up and operational, and otherwise by validation of a provided trademark registration. That validation would be done by the case manager. At WIPO, we employ attorneys to manage cases, so we would envisage that analysis would be done by one of those, with a second check by a trademark expert in-house, if needs be, in cases of uncertainty.
Next question, please.
Rubens Q, for the record. Christina, I wonder if you have looked at the community consensus model for the trademark clearinghouse, which is a PKI-based model, and which you could see if a mark is in the trademark clearinghouse with little, no connection because it's a signed file, or a tightly less coupled structure, so you could verify that the mark is in the clearinghouse, but that would be easily and probably cheaper for free.
Just to restate your question, you're asking if it would be cheaper and more economical if we interface directly with the clearinghouse to verify the registration and proof of use?
Yes, considering that the trademark clearinghouse operates on a PKI-based model that signs the data, so you just need to verify the signature, which is something very easy to do.
It's entirely possible that could actually streamline things. The two questions that I have about that are how much would it cost us to do that, And what sort of liability would be on us as a provider for having to actually go and ourselves get or verify data? The current UDRP model requires the party to submit.
The data.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So then in that case,
just provide the data that is signed. It just verifies the signature.
Yeah. And then so then, yeah, I think that the URS actually sort of contemplates that as an option. It says that the proof of use can be something that's submitted from, that was provided by the Trademark Clearinghouse to the complainant.
Okay. I think we already addressed that following your presentation, Christine, that that the preferred scenario would be that the complainant provide this information from the clearing from the Trademark Clearinghouse in those cases. So that would entail be an attachment to the complaint. And just to verify with that it's actually originated from Trademark Clearinghouse, so no particular extra cost in that regard. Kathy, please.
Kathy Kleiman, Non-Commercial Users Constituency and STI. And I apologize for coming in late. I look forward to looking at the NAF proposal. So my questions are addressed to the WIPO proposal. Three quick clarifying questions. One, on the initial review of the complaint, you said that you're looking to validate trademark rights. The question is, what are you looking for? Are you looking to validate that the string is somehow trademarked? Or are you looking to validate that there's some kind of right in an underlying category of goods and services, or particularly conflicting category of goods and services? Two, regarding the language of the registrant, am I misremembering, but as I understand it, the URS can be responded to in English or the language of the registration agreement, not the registrant per se. So we have to assume that registration agreements are in a more limited number of languages. Does that help? Does that solve your problem? Number three, as part of the STI, we debated default many, many, many times. This was, and I want to double check that you knew that this was a very active question mark. Did you know that default and not having automatic default was a part of the substantive negotiation of this community here, and that we talked about it, we spent many, many, many hours on it, and that we don't view default as a procedural option but as a substantive right, and did you take that into consideration? Thanks for the three questions.
Was that directed to Christine or to David?
Thanks, Kathy, for the questions. In terms of the initial review that the provider would do, it would be a review along the lines of the review that is currently conducted for the UDRP. So the provider would check that the complainant had made a claim of relevant trademark rights. Those rights would need to specify the goods and services to which they applied. There would need to be evidence of those rights that would be provided, and that evidence would be validated by the provider. They would check to see that the complainant had the rights that they claimed that they have. There would not be, if I'm reading this into your question, there would not be an analysis by the provider as to whether or not there would be confusing similarity. There would be an analysis only, and a procedural analysis only, of whether the rights claimed were possessed. And we recognise this, and we recognise that there's an absence of confusing similarity that features in our model, but we believe that given the remedy which is prescribed, which is a temporary reversible suspension, and the fact that the respondent is, under our model, given a right to submit a response, model form response, prescribing a fairly low threshold, that the ability to manage the risks of determinations in against the respondent is sufficiently controlled by the fact that the respondent can come back at any time with a response at no cost and reverse the effect of that suspension remedy. As to the second question concerning language of the proceedings, it's an excellent suggestion, but in our view, we think it probably wouldn't work to use the UDRP model because the UDRP model presumes that the provider... Maybe I've misunderstood the question, but I thought that the suggestion was to look at the registration agreement to determine the language, but the problem procedurally is that the URS doesn't include a mechanism for the provider asking the registrar anything about the disputed domain name, including for purposes of ascertaining the language of the registration agreement. One possible option could be to ask the filing complainant to obtain a copy of the registration agreement themselves, if the actual registration agreement that the registrant used was available for that purpose. But typically, it's not always easy to ascertain that, because registrars can make registration agreements available in multiple languages, and it's only when you ask the registrar what language is it in do you know. So that's why that suggestion might not work so well in the context of this model, at least. And as to the third question, yes, of course, I'm aware of and very respectful of the very extensive deliberations that have gone into the model that we're all currently discussing, URS6, and I'm very sensitive to those. And it's certainly not our suggestion in making the proposal that we are to cause any discomfort in the invested parties in that process, although we're naturally aware that that can be a consequence. But we're trying to make a constructive contribution to getting the cost to a manageable point while also preserving important, sufficient registrant safeguards in a way that enables the model to be rolled out responsibly at the target cost point for the longer term. And this, in our view, is one way to do that. It may be that the community decides that it's not the way they want to go. It may be that there's been too much invested in the deliberations that have already come before, and I think we fully recognise it. We're putting it out there, and if it doesn't fly, then it doesn't.
Jeff, I'm keen to... is that a quick clarifying question? Because we need to proceed with the presentation.
Just to clarify, since Christine mentioned Neustar's procedures, the thing that we do in a nexus dispute is at that stage where if there's a default, we actually don't suspend the name right away. We actually send it's like a breach notice where we give another 30 days to cure. If we're talking about doing something like that as opposed to turning it off, that's actually intriguing. I'm not sure that IP owners here would like the name resolving for another 30 days. But there are trade-offs, and I think it's a good comparison that you made. I will also say it's not attorneys at all that look at it. It's really customer support and much cheaper. So just to clarify.
It's me. For the Nexus disputes, it's me.
You have the Nexus in front of you.
Yeah, when we do the Nexus cases, I do the prima facie review.
Right, I'm saying we actually do, anyway, let's take it offline.
Oh, yeah.
We do it internally first.
Thanks for all those questions and for the answers you provided. And now I would like to proceed to Paul and Bart, and you will come up. You're planning to present something rather different from these proposals, aren't you?
Thank you. You stole my line. I always, in situations like this, think of Monty Python and how they say, and now for something completely different. So we're just going to jump in here. I'm Paul McGrady. I'm a partner at Winston & Strawn. I was also a member of the STI with Kathy, and so we're very familiar with these issues. At the outset, let me say that I have nothing but respect for the NAF and WIPO and all the work that they've done in presenting this today. While we think being a UDRP provider might be helpful, in this particular case, it's not advanced the ball of implementation quickly enough. And as a community, especially with these dates coming back at us rather than away from us, which is, that's unusual in ICANN land, right? We're simply out of time. We're going to just talk a little bit about what our plans are, but the bottom line is we don't believe that material changes to the URS are necessary in order to reach the community price point, nor is it necessary to move away from actual trademark experts serving as panelists and making determinations on whether or not a domain name is confusingly similar to the mark being asserted. These are material changes to the ERS, and if we're going to start over, essentially, then we've missed the ball. To my right is Brad Bertolio. Brad is an intellectual property lawyer who left private practice and actually started a business, which he'll describe, and is now interested in putting forth a response to the RFI. So if Brad, if you could take it from here, and we're going to be available for questions.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everybody. Again, my name is Brad Bertolio. My background, as Paul mentioned, originally was as an intellectual property lawyer. Once I left the practice, I started a legal staffing and legal process outsourcing company. And what we really focused on was building a team that could take high-volume, repeatable legal processes and radically reduce their cost and increase the quality. There's a couple ways that we did this. And the three levers that we really pull on are technology, people, and process improvement techniques. And we think the same approach actually could be applied to the URS procedure as it currently exists without significant substantive changes to provide the service at the price point that's contemplated. We only have a few minutes, so I'll just briefly touch on some of the ideas behind the approach that we're taking on this. With regard to technology, this is really an important piece, obviously. I think there's been a lot of discussion about that today. And what we've seen in the legal process outsourcing space is that that is really a crutch that we rely on to operate in environments that really, I think, the price pressure is even greater than here. So the key points that we look at are, number one, we automate completely or as much as possible anything that involves the objective evaluation of information and objective handling of information. And then we really focus on, two, optimizing the way that attorneys interface with the technology to allow them to make quick subjective decisions. And when you really break up the tasks this way and try and handle them as thoroughly as possible, there's pretty marked improvements that you can get. We've seen in other contexts where we had to perform legal analysis of documents and information and draw legal conclusions, not just having a technology platform, but having an optimized technology platform and really optimizing the way it's used has made a big difference. We had one matter where we moved from one online process to another online process that was better and got a 2x improvement in productivity and a 20% improvement in quality. So it's more than just having a portal and being online, but it's actually implementing it in a really effective way. The second lever that we think about is people, and UDRP experience and expertise is critical, obviously, but URS is a different process. It's got different legal criteria, and we think there's opportunities to kind of think fresh about how this process can be staffed while still taking advantage of the globally diverse trademark expertise that the community offers. And then the third lever I mentioned was process management. And I think it's important to remember that the URS procedure as it exists right now is in many ways a high-level procedure. There's a lot of implementation details that go into how the high-level procedure is implemented, and we think there's a ton of opportunity there to drive out costs, whether you think of it or call it Six Sigma process improvement or lean process improvement or just common sense. There's a lot of business techniques that can be used to improve this process and achieve things at cost points that, you know, you might initially think were not possible. So I guess in conclusion, while we think that there probably are some tweaking that still needs to be done, and Christine brought up some great points on what some of those details are. We also think that and recognize that a lot of work has gone into this process as it exists today, and I think the most important conclusion is we think it can be done, actually, as it exists today. And I know there's time constraints rapidly imposing, and there's no reason not to move forward. Thanks.
So the RFI response will be filed under the name of InterSponsive, so we encourage you to look for that. If you are in the room and would like to see a confidential copy of the response before it goes, so you can give us your feedback, we highly encourage you to send me an email, and we'll connect people who have an interest in doing that. We do recognize that there are some small implementation details that remain, and we still believe that there is time to work within the community to get the small implementation details worked out. we don't think that there's time to flip it on its head and start taking out elements and things of that nature. So we're here for any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much, both of you, and apologies to Brad for calling you Bart. It happens. Difficulties with names, yes. So, thanks. Before I open the queue for questions and discussions, I noticed with interest that you mentioned, okay, there may be some tweaks that need to be addressed. Could I poke you a little about that? What tweaks do you see? Could you name two or three that you see necessary to be able to address?
Sure. You know, I think some of the points Christina brought up with regard to time frames and 24 hours or one business day, that's obviously a very important once we get to the actual implementation of the process. Clarifying the language requirement really is going to be important. Not so much that, you know, we can or cannot do it one way or the other, but more a matter of just knowing what we need to do and what the commitment is there.
And what about the numbers game? The number of complaints that can, or rather, the number of domain names that have been covered by one complaint, is that okay with you?
You know, I think that comes to a probably a pricing issue, but and we're still kind of looking at that. But if the pricing is low enough, then I think it scales and still becomes pretty reasonable.
With that, thank you very much. Any questions to Brad and Paul from the other panelists? Well, it's open for comments and discussions. And Jeff, please go ahead.
Yeah, I want to say a huge thank you. Thank you. This is the benefit of competition. This should have been done months and months ago. It's what a number of us in the community asked for. Now, honestly, I haven't seen your presentation, I mean, your proposal. This is why we do it. This is not why we let vendors determine our policy, but we come out with policy. Intermixed with that, we should talk implementation, but we do not let our vendors determine our policy. I think this has been fantastic. Thank you, Paul, and I'm sorry, Brad, for the presentation. This is exactly what we need. We should not worry about the policy aspects at this point. If it turns out after we read the response that there are some deficiencies, that it's not exactly the response we thought we were going to get, that's great. But I would strongly urge, and as I did at the GNSO Council level, we should not be focusing on developing any new policies or changing any policies until we get to evaluate the RFI responses. To do otherwise is, again, being held captive by our vendors, which have been very good. But maybe this proposal actually will help you fine-tune, you know, WIPO and National Arbitration Forum may fine-tune you guys to go back to the drawing board and help you fine-tune your prices and stuff. And that's the beauty of competition. So big thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And I think, Christina, you would like to respond to that.
Hi, Jeff. I just wanted to comment and say I know you missed, you know, my first part of the proposal, but I started out by saying that in the straightforward, straight up, what I call the telephone pole case, MASH can do it for the price you want. But if you look at my slides, you will see all of the ambiguities outlined in the URS. The URS is not a finished document. It is not a complete policy. There are suggestions and parentheticals in there that still need to be fleshed out by the providers or whoever. And so it's very hard to come down and pinpoint an accurate cost estimate, even if I say I can do it for a lot cheaper than I'm doing UDRP, with all of these ambiguous questions still out there. So my question to you is, you said there shouldn't be any more development. Have you read the URS and seen all the parentheticals and all of the ambiguities still lingering in the actual document itself?
Sure, and I think it's a good question. We have to answer those, but that doesn't involve changing the process, which unfortunately, I missed your presentation due to the previous meeting, but WIPO has proposed changing the process. So that's a different discussion. Yes, we have to fill it in, just like we have to do with the claims process. I mean, there's been a bunch of discussions this week about, okay, now we actually have to implement the claims, and there were parts that were left out. Totally understand. But changing the process and developing new policy before we saw the figures is what I was commenting on. But I appreciate that.
Don't go away, Jeff. I have a question for you. We're back to what can happen next. Would you be interested in helping out with the little tweaks here? I mean, we were talking about drafting teams and such at the GNSO Council. But apparently, they all have some concerns about, well, let's call it the details, though. Then, but, well, apparently, work needs to be done. The questions that Christine raised would need to be addressed. But I'll get back to and bug the GNSO Council about that, of course.
Yeah, so if you recall, my offer was to help evaluate the RFI responses. Since we don't really have any skin in the game as a registry, you know, to us, the procedures are pretty clear as to what we have to do. I'd be happy to sit on an evaluation team with ICANN staff to evaluate the responses and see where. I'm also pretty good at procurement, so I'm pretty good at cutting costs and things. But, yes, ultimately, if there are parentheses and things to fill in, I'm happy to work on that. Changing policy, though, is something totally different that should be left not to me, but to everyone.
Jeff, I also recall you mentioning during the webinar that you would be prepared to offer to decide URS cases for a T-shirt, so perhaps you should also be offering your services to Brad and Paul over here.
That's actually how we're going to handle the multiple domain names with the privacy service. Jeff's going to just get clothes. Yeah.
T-shirt. It's got to be a nice one. Maybe a rugby shirt.
Thanks. Now it's Phil, please. You're next in line.
Phil Corwin again, and delighted to hear that there's going to be at least one bid which takes an innovative approach and believes that it can provide the service with the present model without changes at the target price. What disturbs me about the WIPO proposal, which is default with no panel, which means no examination, the URS requires a determination at a higher standard of proof than the UDRP that there's been bad faith registration and use, particularly where the right is in a trademark, which can be a generic name. You cannot know if there's infringement without both seeing if it looks obvious from the domain name and looking at what's going on at the domain to see if there's bad faith use. And this notion that it's okay to suspend domains because there's a chance to come back and it's no big deal, it's a very big deal. There was legislation, very controversial legislation, that Congress deep six this year because called SOPA, based on claims of both copyright and trademark rights, that became so controversial that the internet went dark for a day, that millions of people were bombarding Congress with emails, that the White House took a position that killed the bill, and it was just about suspensions. It wasn't about transfers. So suspending domains that are a platform for commerce and speech is a very big deal. And a proposal that lets a suspension happen without any review of the use of the domain is just not acceptable to the folks I represent. So that's my comment.
Thanks. Any comment to that, or could we go straight to the next in line? Could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Zach Muscovich. I'm from here in Toronto. I'm new to the URS discussion, but I'm not new to domain name disputes. I've handled several hundred in front of the WIPO and NAF. It seems to me, if I recall correctly, back in the 1999 ICANN staff report on the formation of the UDRP was envisioned as a procedure to deal with the clear-cut cases of abusive domain registrations. And so this, I assume, is for the clearest of clear-cut cases. But yet when I look at the models that are being presented of the questions that the complainants must fill out and the answers the response must give, this is really a substantive assessment of the case. It's a mini UDRP, and there may very well be good reason to have such a thing in place. I'm not disputing that. But, you know, after doing this for 13 years, and you guys are experts on this, having done it for that long as well, I don't see how you can lessen the human involvement and the minimal pay that the panelists are already getting for this. So if there is a revolutionary new approach, I'd love to hear about it, but is it going to be kept a secret, or is this something that we can discuss?
Yeah, this, it's not a revolutionary new approach. It is a panelist applying the URS, right? So they look at it, they look at the marks, they look at the domain name, they make a decision about whether or not the mark and the domain name are confusingly similar to each other. That happens about like that. They look at the website, how it's being used, and they say, that's a problem, that's not a problem. Again, that happens pretty quickly. The URS is a different policy than the UDRP. For whatever reason, we now have a UDRP that requires 10, 15 pages. We have panelists writing about whether or not laches apply in jurisdictions where there are no equitable defenses. You know, and so the UDRP is what it is, and it's a fine alternative to the URS in the event that you don't believe that you have that sort of very clear-cut case. And so, yeah, I just think it's a different policy, and it will be applied a different way. You said that we're all experts up here. I'm never referred that way to myself whenever John Berryhill's in the room because he always beats me.
And, well, I'm half reluctant to give John the floor, and I don't think we can go any further because we are a hard stop at 1 p.m., and that's what it is right now. So can you be very, very quick in your comment, John? Or is it a lengthy one? Please don't.
It's a lengthy one. It's a quick one. It's a quick one. It's the one that I always like to do at every URS presentation. And really, David... I want to encourage you to really rethink about this, you know, automatic suspension on default, because the fact of the matter is that the substantive evaluation component of this should be very simple, as Zach said and as Phil said. What I like to do at every URS presentation is read some cases, just the domain names, and this will take 10 seconds, from the currently pending list of cases at WIPO. NestleHealthSciences.com, PorscheRacing.com, DeutscheBankIndia.com, WaldorfAstoriaNewYork.com, GucciOutletSalesStore.com. It's not going to take anybody more than 15 seconds to know what's going to happen with those cases, unless there's something really interesting going on. Maybe somebody named Porsche is racing, but you can figure that out pretty quickly. Then there's, you know, Beehive.com and Arab-Health.org. Those are obviously things that, you know, when they come across the desk, whatever the claim is, that might need some other thought. It is not a process that requires, you know, a tremendous amount of deliberation to sort these into, you know, questions requiring thought and questions that can be decided quickly. That's all.
Thanks, John, and I'm sorry, but we do have to stop right now and conclude because we're running over time. And yes. Right.
Me, I won't be long. I'm Carolyn Pierre from Nestle, so I'm glad you brought up the examples. We have a few others. Just one or two comments. First, I don't see why we cannot review the process. If we see that today the process is not going to work, this is going to be used for long term, so it's really the time to review it. So it has to be efficient and it has to be sustainable. I go back on David's point. It's really very important that it's sustainable. There is UDRP. If we have really hard cases and we need to go into the depth of the cases, but the URS could be a very good tool for the brand owners. So thank you.
Thank you. And on a concluding note, well, we have here heard three different approaches and a number of comments and a number of things that need to be done. Of course, we have the RFI going, and we will look very closely and with great interest in the results from that. And in the meantime, having talked to the Genus of Council and the ALAC, well, they are willing to set up a drafting team in standby, given certain conditions, notably that the providers provide some input on cost elements and things like that for further discussions. And, of course, we have got a lot of material from today, so I will incite the Genus of Council to put that drafting team into effect, and to which I also would incite the providers to join forces so we can get some, well, first of all, weed out the things that need weeding out, and then grapple with whatever questions that need addressing. So thank you very much for attending today, and, well, There is more to follow. This is just the beginning of the end.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now resetting this room. Would you please move to the exits as promptly as possible? Thank you.